In the following podcast, dialogue has been condensed from a military trial's transcripts. The story is a recreation of an actual criminal case that occurred in North Vietnam and has been adapted to a podcast from one of my films. And this is a Dead Bug podcast, and it may not be suited for those of a sensitive nature. Yeah, you said it, not me. Pussies. So proceed at your own peril.
Earlier this year, top U.S. leaders vowed that the U.S. Marine outpost at Khe Sanh, then under a 77-day enemy siege, would be defended at all costs.
Welcome to North Vietnam. And it was late in 1967 that the name Pinkville came to be known. Now you'd be excused with such a name like that, thinking it was some sort of homosexual's paradise, where they're handing out blowjobs like bisexual elves are handing out candy canes. Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, Mary Poppins, because what Pinkville was something far much worse. A roadside to the abyss. A Grim Reaper's syphilitic paradise.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all began. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
9 days, American and Trump Vietnamese troops are trying to take a mountain near the ocean border. 10 times they've been thrown back.
On this Dead Bug joint, I will take a look at the village known as Pinkville. By 1969, the American people had soured with the thought of the conflict in Vietnam. And it seemed that the country was ripping apart at the seams. Because it weren't like one of those war movies starring John Wayne. Because in this one, no one were getting a girl. What if we're getting anything? We were a bad case of the clap. And it seemed the generations couldn't agree if none were right or wrong.
Many brave men died in this country to make it free. They believe that. They let you have everything.
Senator Fulbright said some months ago that if the Vietnam War went on much longer, the best of our young people would be in Canada. See, as for these deserters, malcontent, radical, incendiaries, the civil and the uncivil disobedience among our young, SDS, PLP, Weatherman 1, Weatherman 2, the Revolutionary Action Movement, Panthers, Lions, Hippies, Yippies, Tigers alike, I'd rather swap the whole damn zoo for a single platoon of the kind of young Americans I saw in Vietnam.
But it was only a year earlier that things were different, and there were those who still thought that they were fighting a noble war against a brown devil who ate his meals where he shit. But anyone entering it thinking it were your typical conflict like the ones you'd see in the newsreels, they were thrown by an elusive enemy. The Vietnam War exposed a fundamental mismatch in how wars were fought. The United States entered Vietnam with overwhelming firepower, advanced technology, and a doctrine built around large-scale conventional warfare. But the enemy, the Viet Cong, well, I guess they didn't get the memo. Instead, they relied on guerrilla tactics that meant small mobile units, ambushes, and a deep knowledge of the terrain. Dense jungles, rice paddies, and tunnel systems allowed them to appear, strike quickly, and then disappear like cockroaches before the American forces could respond effectively. There were no clear front lines in Vietnam, no obvious targets, and often no way to distinguish fighters from civilians. I guess they really did all look alike. And that was one of the biggest challenges. The Viet Cong blended into the local population. By day, someone might be a farmer. By night, they could be part of the insurgent network. This made it incredibly difficult for American soldiers to identify the enemy, leading to constant uncertainty and psychological strain. Then there were the tactics themselves, booby traps, punji stakes, and improvised explosives that were used not just to kill, but to maim and slow down the U.S. troops. The jungle environment amplified this. Heat, disease, insects, limited visibility made even the basic movement exhausting and dangerous. Meanwhile, the Americans often relied on search and destroy missions, large sweeps through the countryside intended to locate and eliminate enemy forces. But the Gook, well, they didn't stand a fight. They avoided direct confrontation until it suited them. Meanwhile, U.S. forces could clear a whole area one day, only to find the enemy had returned the next. At its core, the difficulty came down to this. The U.S. were fighting a conventional war against an unconventional enemy. Superior weapons and numbers mattered less when the opponent controlled the terrain, dictated the terms of engagement, and could effectively disappear and reappear whenever they wanted. And that's what made Vietnam such a frustrating and ultimately unwinnable conflict for the United States. But despite most of the South Vietnamese seeing the Americans as unwanted guests, by 1968, they'd become reliant on them.
Since the U.S. began its big buildup in the mid-60s, millions of dollars worth of goods have entered the country each month. Some economists say 10% or more of the cargo is diverted into black market channels.
Because although they didn't care too much for the American soldier, they had no problem with the goods that came along with them. With the South Vietnamese civilians playing the one for you, two for me game. The South Vietnamese economy had now become dependent on the swinging dicks that they like to call behind their backs, invaders. But it was a false economy, and as we know, all good things come to an end.
To you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support. I pledged in my campaign for the presidency to end the war in a way that we could win the peace.
Feeling public sentiment slipping, Nixon started showing up in everyone's living room to convince him otherwise.
The more support I can have from the American people, the sooner that pledge can be redeemed. For the more divided we are at home, the less likely the enemy is to negotiate at Paris. Let us be united for peace.
As the body bags kept returning home, the war became less and less popular with the American public. Many historians and analysts now agree that America lost the war because they based success on a kill ratio. They lost three men and killed 100 gooks. Well, it were a good day. But North Vietnam had more than just a military. Their entire people were VC. The kids, the women, the old men. It seemed that all of them were planting booby traps and acting as a lookout. You see, the Viet Cong weren't fighting a traditional war. And for all the Americans knew, even the local farmer might have had a claymore stuff up his ass. If they wanted to win, well, they were gonna have to start thinking like the dink, or at least have the balls to cut the head off the dog. It was sometime in March of 1968 that Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry, had been assigned to Task Force Barker to assist on a search and destroy mission under the Tongan Peninsula. there had been one village that had turned into a particular ball lake, because Ray Khan had reported that it had a gook infestation. Their words, not mine. Laying booby traps wherever you put your foot down. Type of booby trap that wouldn't kill you, but it'd blow out both your legs. And the men in Task Force Barker had a special name for the area, Pinkville. And why they call it that, I don't know, but ain't important to the story. But one thing's for sure, they all knew if you were passing through Pinkville, you'd be leaving without a limb, or worse still, your life. And his reputation was spreading quicker than the syphilis that the gook hookers were giving the soldiers for $5 a pop. And no one wanted to receive orders saying they were going to Pinkville. It was early in the morning in March that Task Force Barker headed out to a hamlet called Melee, known to the Americans as Pinkville. A name that would put fear in any soldier's heart, with them joking that even the chickens seemed to be gooks and be hostile towards them, with all of them being told that their mission was to go into Pinkville and eradicate the problem. Any villagers who ran from Charlie Company were ordered by the encircling companies to execute them. When Charlie Company arrived at the outskirts of the village, as if to set the tone, a small boy, maybe 3 or 4, approached them, curious. A radio operator raised his M16, blew the kid's head off. With the lieutenant barking out, "There are no innocent civilians, there are only gooks." Then one of the company's officers, a second lieutenant, Callie, gathered up several groups of the villagers, mostly women, children, and old men. And then they executed them on the spot. And anyone who tried to run, they were cut down. And if they were good enough to get past that, they were taken out by the company encircling the village. And then they were ordered to burn the village down to the ground. One of the soldiers would later report they slaughtered villagers like they were sheep and livestock. With the females, even the children, not getting off so lightly because they were raped before they got to taste the bullet. And after that, there were one big party. It didn't take long before word had started spreading to other units and civilians about a massacre in a place that they called Pinkville. One private in a whorehouse indulging after a night of heavy drinking broke down and cried in the hooker's arms, saying he couldn't get the image of the women and children that he'd murdered out of his head. He'd dream about them, with them staring at him with the wounds in their head.
What kind of people? Men, women, children?
Men, women, children.
Babies?
Babies. Lieutenant Kelly came over and said, "You know what to do with them, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." So I took for granted that he just wanted us to watch him. And he left and came back about 10 or 15 minutes later and said, "How come you ain't killed him yet?"
You killed how many at that time?
Well, I fired them on automatic, so you can't, you just spray the area on them, so you really don't know how many you killed, but it comes out so doggone fast. So I might have killed about 10, 15 of them.
Men, women, and children?
Men, women, and children.
And babies?
And babies. Why did I do it? Because I felt like I was ordered to do it. And it seemed like, at the time I felt like I was doing the right thing. Or I did. Because, like I said, I lost buddies. I lost a good, damn good buddy, Bobby Wilson. And it was on my conscience. It was on. So after I'd done it, I felt good. Later on that day, you're getting to me.
It's so hard, I think, for a good many Americans to understand that young, capable, brave American boys could line up old men, women, children, and babies and shoot them down in cold blood. How do you explain that?
I wouldn't know.
The killing of enemy civilians and wars and conflicts, well, it ain't new. But many observers were to note is that it had never been so intimate and up close as at Pinkville. Using bayonets, grenades, and guns. Bashing babies to death with the butts of their M16s. With the final death count being 407. Old people, ladies, and babies. When experts and scholars look back and analyze My Lai and the massacre that occurred there, the uncomfortable truth is that the soldiers involved, they weren't monsters in most cases. But it was after they arrived. What happened to them is better explained by a set of powerful psychological pressures that can push ordinary people into extraordinary violence. First is the dehumanization in Vietnam. The enemy was often invisible. No uniforms, no clear front lines. Over time, soldiers were trained implicitly or explicitly to see the local population not as individuals, but as potential threats. And language played a role here. Derogatory names like Gook, Slope, Charlie, Dink, Zipperheads, and general loss of trust with the locals eroded any empathy. When you stop seeing someone fully human, the barrier to harming them drops. Man, they just become fucking animals at the end of a barrel. Second is fear and frustration. The U.S. troops were fighting a guerrilla war against an enemy like the Viet Cong, who could strike and disappear. Booby traps, ambushes, and constant uncertainty created a sense of danger that was everywhere. When soldiers took casualties without ever seeing a clear enemy, that frustration could build into anger, sometimes redirected towards civilians, because they didn't even know if they were civilians. Then there's obedience to authority and group pressure. In high-stress combat situations, soldiers rely heavily on orders and on each other. If a commanding officer signals directly or indirectly that extreme measures are acceptable, individuals are far more likely to go along. Psychological studies have shown that ordinary people will carry out harmful actions if they believe authority justifies it. Another factor is moral disengagement. In war, the usual rules of society are already suspended. Violence becomes normalized. Over time, actions that would be unthinkable in civilian life can start to feel permissible, especially when framed as necessary for survival or mission success. And then finally, there's the groupthink, the group dynamics. No one wants to be an outsider in a tight-knit unit. If others are participating or no one's objecting, it becomes much harder for an individual to step in and say no. Silence can become complicity. None of this excuses what happened, but it does explain how environments like Nam could push ordinary people into committing acts that outside of that context, they ended up doing things that once upon a time would have seemed unimaginable. But still, there were those in Pinkville who disobeyed orders, and they risked their lives doing it. Because although the body count was high, it could have been much higher if it weren't for individuals like helicopter pilot Hugh Thompson, who brought his helicopter down between the soldiers and their intended victims and ordered his crew to fire upon any of his fellow Americans that didn't stop firing upon civilians. Not knowing that less than a mile away, another company had killed 97 innocent women and children. It was later reported that not every soldier took part in the massacre that day, and some of them, despite orders, led women and children away to safety. Hugh Thompson was the first to break the code of silence and report what he saw, but no one in his chain of command did anything about it. And it turned out to be one of the Vietnam War's biggest cover-ups. It was only later, when an ex-corporal named Ronald Ridenhour, who had heard about it from several other soldiers while on leave, he wrote several letters to the president, as well as 12 other high-ranking individuals in the military and the government, because he said he couldn't get it out of his head what the soldiers had told him, and he wouldn't be able to live with himself unless he said something. The first thing that President Nixon did when he heard about it was investigate those who'd reported the slaughter, telling his aide that it was those dirty, rotten Jews from New York who were behind it, and he'd get them.
Now, I understand that there has been and continues to be opposition to the war in Vietnam on the campuses and also in the nation. We expect it. However, under no circumstances will I be affected whatever by it.
When news of the massacre reached the American public, even the most fervent of war supporters were now having their doubts.
Charges have been made that troops of the AmeriCal division killed as many as 567 South Vietnamese civilians during a sweep in March 1968.
I guess they didn't consider gooks and zipperheads to be babies and old people. Eventually, Lieutenant General William R. Pierce was put in charge of the investigation. A man who was a hero, they knew he couldn't be corrupted. Pierce's investigation concluded that 30 American soldiers, including their division commander, had either committed the atrocities or conspired to cover them up. When Pierce had concluded his investigation, he'd wanted to call it a massacre, but his superiors made him change it and eventually describe what had happened in Pinkville as a tragedy of major proportions. In the end, the Army indicted 25 officers and men, including the platoon leader, Lieutenant William Kelly, who had been on the ground ordering the men, as he also pulled the trigger. Historically, it's hard to categorize what happened to My Lai when measuring it up against other tragedies in a war that now seems to have no point. And most likely, it'll be forgotten in history as generations come and go. And what happened to My Lai isn't just a story about war. It's a warning about people. Because the most unsettling lesson isn't that evil exists. It's that it doesn't always arrive looking like a monster. Sometimes it looks like exhaustion. Like fear. Like following orders. One step too far. My Lai forces us to confront something uncomfortable that under the right or the wrong conditions, ordinary people can cross lines they once believed were unbreakable. Not because they set out to become killers, but because those lines erode slowly, quietly, until they're gone. But there's another lesson too, because even there, in that moment, not everyone complied. A few chose to resist, to intervene, to say no. And that matters, because it reminds us that while the capacity for darkness exists, so does the responsibility to stand up against it, even when it's unpopular, even when it's dangerous. My Lai isn't just history. It's a question. What would you do if you were there?
Gonna be alright. I can leave. for a while. But don't you crack a smile. Don't look into my eyes or I might stay. Cause I can see it coming. I think I might be falling for a January love. The timing is tragic, but this winter has a magic. Makes my heart come undone. And I guess I don't mind a January love. Mm. Tell me a lie. Just gonna end like the other times when I stay behind. Call me a fool. Tell me I'm better off without you. To forget you. But don't you crack a smile. Don't look into my eyes. Don't you make me fall. Don't ruin it all, or I may never leave. Cause I can see it coming. I think I might be falling for a January love. Timing is tragic, but this winter has a magic. Makes my heart come undone. And I guess I don't mind. I guess I don't mind a January love.
Citizens, this is Deadbug. Friend, lover, father, father of many, actually, and some of them are from those godless third world countries, and I gotta support them all. Well, not the ones from the godless third world countries, because, you know, their cords can't touch me, but nevertheless, the other ones, I gotta divvy up some money sometimes, and you can help me. Sign up to my Patreon, where you get hundreds of my podcasts and three times as many of my films. And you won't be disappointed.
No siree, Bob.
And I'll also send you intimate photos when I'm drunk. So what are you waiting for? I'll see yous all over there. God bless each and every one of yous. Well, except for yous from those godless nations, which I won't mention. But your money is still good. Oh, and remember, with each 100th sign up, I'm going to buy one of my kids a pack of smokes and maybe even get them vaccinated. I thank you.